So this talk tonight, the only title I could think of is some interesting aspects of our mindfulness and loving kindness techniques. So in the spirit of offering you a couple of things that I've found very, very interesting to share with you. So in our session, for example, today, we had two main techniques. We had a mindfulness technique, and then we had heart-opening, loving-kindness, Brahma-vihara, those techniques, loving-kindness, compassion, and appreciative joy. So this tradition, we in the West call it Vipassana tradition. Actually, that's kind of a new way of speaking of meditation, insight meditation. So we practice techniques, mindfulness, loving kindness, a variety of others. We also study wise reflection and eventually leading to special insight. Along the way, of course, there are lots of other insights that come. People know you get a lot of psychological insight from meditating. But for insight meditation, we're talking about deeper insights, insights into the nature of reality itself. So this is called special insight. So that's a sort of the long-term aspect of the adventure. Special insight rises, and of course, even longer, the notion of deeper and deeper realization. Some people call it enlightenment. Those kinds of things can show. So in this journey, we have a lot of resources. We have teachings, we have books, we have study, and we have practices and practice techniques. So I'd like to say some things about those techniques and how they relate to each other. I have a lot of trust in the practices themselves. I did a lot of study and received a lot of teachings from a wide variety of teachers, but I was fortunate enough from a fairly youngish age to have the opportunity to do a lot of meditation, to do a lot of intensive meditation. So I have tremendous faith in the techniques themselves, because ultimately they are what I witnessed in myself as creating a transformation in my life experience. So I like them a lot, the techniques, practices. So one thing I discovered in the writings of a really wonderful American teacher of Tibetan Buddhism, Ken MacLeod, just very, very good modern teacher of Tibetan Buddhism. One article he wrote where he, in an effort to clear up a lot of confusion, really said some things very, very well. So I want to give him the credit and then share that with you. What he said is that often for us as practitioners, beginners, and also those much further along than beginners, is that we confuse these different aspects of our practice, and particularly our practice techniques. So let's take our mindfulness technique and then also the loving kindness techniques, for example. And what you can say about them is that there is a purpose and a method technique, and then there are effects, and then there are results. And that we often confuse these a lot and get ourselves tangled up in frustration with the practice or frustration with ourselves or misunderstanding because we confuse those things. So again, it's purpose, method, effect, and result. So, for example, the purpose of, say, our breathing technique, our breathing practice, mindfulness practice, is to cultivate attention. And I love he's offered us this word attention, which quite similar to mindfulness, except often we get confused, like what the heck is mindfulness anyway? Because it's a new word, from our half century of this kind of meditation, mindfulness. But attention we get. So our mindfulness, our practice with the breathing, mindfulness practice, mindfulness technique is training us to move our attention somewhere and rest it there. And that's the purpose of those kinds of practices. I guided you in the breathing, using the breathing as an anchor, but there are many other ways to train mindfulness, to train attention, but it involves moving our attention somewhere and resting it there. In the walking meditation, we move our attention from the wandering and the thinking to the sensations of movement. And then we rest our attention there, even as those sensations move and change. And that's the purpose. So then the method, and I just mentioned a couple of methods. The method can be breathing practice. Method could be walking meditation. So there are a variety of methods. A secondary purpose that we might take as leading to the special insight, which would distinguish using the breath as a simple concentration technique with the way we use it, the subtle way we use it, which is to also allow our attention, after we notice the mind has wandered, so we notice, but instead of going right back to the breath, immediately, we actually take just an extra moment or two, just a quick glimpse. There's one book on Vipassana that's called Glimpse After Glimpse. We take a quick look and allow ourselves to actually see the thinking mind. We notice thinking. Or as we get a little bit more advanced, we're very quick to notice maybe our mind has the habit of planning. So we notice that. Or maybe it's remembering, worrying, judging, regretting, comparing. So we begin to see that very, very quickly, that the story is about planning or the story is about judging. Or we just use the generic word thinking. But that's an important distinction. It's just a moment or two, but it's very important. It turns what might just be a concentration practice into a insight practice. Because over time, with those quick glimpses, we're going to be able to begin to see the landscape of the mind itself and how it works. The reason they have to be quick, of course, is because if we stay too long, we get sucked back into the story. It's like flypaper, you know? So we have to build this skill. You know, it'd be great to just be able to observe in a detached way as the thinking unfolds, but it's not how it happens. We get sucked back in. So we have to develop the skill, look quick. Then there is that moment of renunciation where sometimes what we were involved in when we woke up or you heard my voice or something, that distraction is actually often so much more interesting to us than the breath sensations. So we actually have to have a moment of renunciation there, which is, again, we think often that the monastics are the people who are involved in renunciation. But actually, this practice, it's so brilliant. It actually allows us to cultivate the mental factor of renunciation. And as I said, that's a powerful mental factor. It's got to be with us, and it's got to be strengthened all the way up through the deeper and deeper and deeper levels of insight meditation, all the way to the factors of enlightenment. Renunciation has to be there. So there's this moment, and you can actually feel it sometimes. You know, particularly notice if you're really caught in just your favorite distracting story, you know? And then you wake up or you hear someone as a great gift to you, coughs. So you, and I'm planning, you know, my schedule for next week, and this is the first time I had any time to plan, but now I'm supposed to be meditating. So there's that moment. Do we stay with the thoughts, or do we go back to the breath? And we have to energize some renunciation sometimes to get back to the breath. And then we return to this moment. So glimpse after glimpse, we begin to see a number of aspects of the landscape of the mind that we haven't seen before. So that's another purpose for the method that we use. So we have purpose and method, but then effects versus results. And here's where we might get tangled up again, particularly folks who are beginning, but often people with a lot of experience get tangled up here, because we sometimes think that, say for example, maybe today, one of the effects of this meditation session might be calm and peace. And then we begin to think, we might begin to make the mistake that that's the point of this kind of practice. We're supposed to be calm and peaceful because it was the effect of one day or even many meditations. And then we think if it's not calm and peaceful at the end of meditation, we've done something wrong. If the effect of the meditation is restlessness or pain in the body, then we may think that we've done something wrong. But actually, in this kind of meditation, that's not true at all. The results over time are what begin to give us a sense that the effects of one session are not as important as the results over time. So Ken McLeod gives us this great example for this. He says, take exercise, right? So we exercise. Exercise has a purpose. Maybe it's, you know, to strengthen our body. Maybe it has to do with losing weight, staying flexible, something like that. But we have a purpose. Then we have a method. Maybe some people walk, some people run, some people swim, some people do racquetball. You know, there's a lot of different methods. Then effects and results. Okay, sometimes the effects of an hour of racquetball would be complete and total exhaustion. You know, you just collapse. Sometimes the effects of running is feeling very energized and alive. Sometimes the effect is something in between that. Sometimes the effect of an exercise session is the next day sore muscles all day. But we realize that our exercise sessions will have different effects. But what we're looking for is the results over time. And that's what we care about. So it's not like, oh, one day our muscles are so sore because we exercised the previous day. So we don't say, oh, I'm giving this up because these sore muscles are unpleasant. Rather, we just say, ha, it's good. It means I had a good session, you know. And we keep going because we're looking to the results that are over time make us healthier. So this is also true with our mindfulness practice and insight practice. The effects may vary. And so we learn not to expect particular effects from one session. But it's hard sometimes because sometimes the effects are really sweet. So then we get this idea, well, yeah, it's always supposed to be sweet after meditation. We're always supposed to be relaxed and calm. But then that means we might think that if we're not that way, we've done something wrong. And we haven't. Just life is how it is. There are certain things that happen during a day that mean when you come here that night, there's no way you're going to be concentrated. You know? That's just life is like that. But we come anyway. We do the practice. So then looking at, say, the loving-kindness techniques, loving-kindness, compassion, and joy, again, we have a purpose. So what's the purpose of that? Well, generally speaking, we might say the purpose, training the heart to soften, to open more. So let's say that's the purpose of loving-kindness meditation, certainly one of the purposes. then the method, in this case, the method we use, the method I led you in, is, you know, pretty much derived from Burmese style of training in the loving kindness practice. You know, of course, my modifications of it, but Brahmavihara style, where we have a pattern. You know, we have a certain number of beings, and we use one, the loving kindness benefactor, and that being, thinking of that being, I was to say, it pushes the loving kindness button. If you get the right benefactor, then when you think of that benefactor, you will actually feel the feeling of loving kindness. So that's really important, to feel that. And then it's sequential for compassion. We don't first think of our loving kindness benefactor, because that doesn't give rise to compassion. That gives rise to happiness and friendliness. So instead, the first being we think of is someone who we care about, who is in some difficulty. So the method is outlined in the tradition, and how we follow it. Then the effects could be very different for different people. Some people, they might really enjoy the loving kindness practice and feel at the end of it, you know, quite moved by it. Other people might find it quite boring. You know, some people, I know someone in this group, I don't know if they're here tonight, but told me one year, and I did the workshop on loving kindness, that he always does the technique but felt a little bit bad because it seemed so contrived to him. And he looked very relieved when I said, well, that's because it is contrived. So he didn't feel bad, because he thought it maybe the effect for him was he felt the sense of being contrived. But then maybe he thought that there was something wrong with him because he felt it was contrived. But compare again to exercise, you know. That is quite contrived. You go, like weightlifting, you know, and they hand you things, and they say, move it this way, and then move it this way, and then put your elbows close to your body, and turn your hand this way, and then do this. You know, and all of that is exceedingly contrived. But the results are different than the effects. You know, effects of that is you're really sore that day and the next day. But the results are that over time, if you do this weird contrived thing, sometimes with the machines, you end up stronger. You can pick up your groceries more easily. You can pick up your grandchildren or your children more easily. So that's the distinction, the results. We're not doing these weird motions so that we can walk down the street doing these weird motions. You know, it's quite contrived, but its purpose ends up with a result that is strength. So it's true also that the loving kindness techniques and practices, regardless of the effect of one session, whether you do feel that the heart opened, or you felt something, or you really loved it, or you were bored to death, or you really hated it, it's useful to keep doing it anyway, even though those effects are different, because over time, the results can be quite extraordinary and quite surprising. Now, at the beginning, the only way we know about that is we hear from other people, or from Sharon Salzberg's wonderful books, other people's books that give us these stories of results that we can say, oh, okay, all right. They're also comforting to us because they tell us that it doesn't matter whether you're bored or not, or whatever the daily effect of doing the practice is, but rather to hang in there, and then over time you can look and see the results. And so I'd like to say some things about the results of that particular practice, because they're sometimes surprising. Sometimes they're quite obvious, but sometimes they can surprise us. But I guarantee you will see them. You will see some results. One student I have said the first results he saw was other people told him about it. They said, wow, have you changed? he wasn't quite aware of that, but then they pointed out certain situations where there might be strong reaction, that he no longer had those strong reactions. Another student said that and she offered me this story to share. She had been, she's I think in her 70s now, late 70s, maybe more. So she had been quite a wonderful gardener in her life. And now she takes a lot of walks for her exercise. And she noticed that over time, without that intention, but first the mindfulness practice gave her the gift of being able to notice when she was walking that her mind was actually quite critical of the gardens as she passed, you know, that people weren't out there attending to them. This one had a lot of weeds, that one this, that sort of thing. And then over time, she's been practicing the loving kindness for several years now. Without intending to, again, she began to notice that her mental story, as she takes her walk, looking in the gardens, had transformed little by little over time, to the point now where when someone's garden was a mess, instead of thinking critically or judgmentally, she would immediately be concerned about the person. Maybe they couldn't get out to their yard anymore to take care of it. She saw that she appreciated just a lot more, that her whole inner attitude while taking her walk in relation to the gardens was gentle friendliness, which is the word metta in Pali language, sometimes translated as gentle, sometimes translated as friend or friendly. So she actually saw those results. And in an area where she wasn't expecting or intending, she didn't intend to apply her practice there, just happened to notice that as she saw her mind and heart change. These sort of things can happen. But then often we don't realize that these practices of loving kindness, compassion, and joy can actually change our mindfulness practice, our breathing meditation, our insight practice, our experience of that. But think about that for a minute. When we sit in our mindfulness practice, sometimes we go through some struggles because what's arising in our minds and our emotions and our bodies is difficult for us. Unpleasant body sensation, pain, you know, difficult memories, all kinds of things that come up. If over time, again, I don't know, we did this the last time. Those of you in the back can't hear this, but those of us who are in the front can hear the choir rehearsing on the other side of this wall. And sometimes there's sort of a great swell. And often it seems to punctuate the talk, doesn't it? So, again, we had a little punctuation there. It's really kind of nice, isn't it? Seriously, holy music going on back there. So in our mindfulness meditation, what if a little by little over time we're more and more able to experience an attitude of gentle friendliness to what arises in our mindfulness practice? And this happens as a result of the loving kindness practice. And people often don't realize that. When they think, of course, the loving kindness practice will change my experience in daily life and, you know, attitudes toward people and so forth. But it actually has a huge benefit on the mindfulness practice because it's often difficult to concentrate if we're struggling and we don't like what's happening here. But if we have an attitude, if we have the ability to open the heart with gentle friendliness to whatever's arising and passing, then we can concentrate better and our sitting practice is strengthened. And then compassion, the practice of compassion. Again, you can see right away, of course, changes, or you can imagine changes outside situations. But then, what about our sitting meditation? What if compassion is strengthened in us? What if we're just more willing to actually see our own pain and be kind toward ourselves? That's also going to result in stronger sitting meditation in the mindfulness practice. Once again, we'll be able to concentrate better. Once again, we'll be able to soften toward our own experience. A lot of us have experienced a lot of self-judgment, self-criticism, guilt, shame. We see it in our sitting practice, and compassion is a wonderful antidote to that. So as we train in the compassion practice, the result is also that during our sitting meditation, we notice a softening toward ourselves. We notice more tender-hearted mercy toward ourselves and toward our own experience, and it strengthens our mindfulness practice, our insight practice, really benefits. Another thing that you might not... It's very surprising, the association is compassion and confidence. It's not something you would think of right away, but compassion, developing more compassion, results in more confidence. But it does. Really, really does. It results in more confidence in the outside world and also more confidence in our practice as we're sitting, as we're practicing. And again, this is something, if you think about it, it's hard to think about it, doesn't it? Like, how does that fit? But when you feel it, you know it fits. You know it relates. But an example, a classic example, of course, is people generally don't like to speak in public to groups. And part of that is that when we get up in front of a group, all kinds of stuff arises inside of us. You know, there's a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear, maybe a sense of that we will be judged by others. That's one of the biggest ones. They did research long, long ago now that said that many people would rather die than have to speak in front of a group. So that means one feels pretty seriously threatened, right? So that's an antagonistic kind of feeling that somehow one would be attacked or judged. And of course, sometimes, you know, or you can remember back in college, some people antidote that by being a very aggressive public speaker. So they figure, well, they're going to criticize everybody out there before they get criticized. You know, it's sort of a best defense is a good offense kind of strategy, and maybe you know or have experienced people, that's their speaking style. But underneath that, of course, is still that fear, that anxiety. But if we cultivate compassion, and the aspect of the compassion and the reason that I guide it in the way that I do is they talk about compassion is actually being able to feel, experience, and know others' pain. So, of course, the classic definition is the quivering of the heart as a response to pain. So there has to be a willingness to feel others' pain and a willingness to feel our own pain. Once you once that ability grows, and it's really, it's an ability to actually be willing and able to feel the pain of others. But as that grows, one feels less and less and less threatened. I remember I had one opportunity to be in the audience when Krishnamurti was speaking toward the end of his life. And then afterwards, we were all outside. It was down at Ojai. And so just by happenstance, because of the way the crowd moved, I, for a few minutes, was just within a few feet of him. And you know, those of you who know about him, he's kind of a fierce fellow in his speaking, and you hardly could dare ask him a question because it was terrifying, because he'd say, you know, if he didn't like your question, you know, and then he'd say, don't ask a possible question. I don't even want to hear a possible question. Ask me an impossible question. You know? But so I walked and I was just close enough to him, and I was astounded. The palpable vulnerability that being had let go of everything, any kind of defense, self-orientation. Whatever was going to happen was going to happen, and he was not going to stop it. You know, it's sort of lucky the whole group was friendly, you know, but there have been people, you know, we think of Gandhi, also that vulnerability and what happened to him. That openness, such, and it's a confidence and an awareness that whatever happens, if it's, you know, difficult, painful, critical, judgmental, whatever comes at you in that way from another being is coming from their suffering. And once you know that and you feel that, then you don't worry so much anymore about speaking in front of people, going in front of people. Yeah, they might criticize, they might judge, they might attack. But when you know and you really feel that it's coming from suffering, then your guard is no longer up. There's that sense of wanting to somehow find a way to be there for them in their suffering. How they have to act it out, well, you know, that's not the important part. And so then the result of that is a confidence that the moment is okay. Whatever happens, even if, you know, this one makes a fool of herself, you know, that's life. That's okay. And that whatever comes from people, again, if it's painful, it's coming from their pain. And again, as a practitioner on this path, we want to learn to make space for pain, our own pain and the pain of others. So this odd connection, compassion and confidence, is really true. You kind of have to feel it, taste it a bit. You get to know that sense of it. And then this energy, appreciative joy, sympathetic joy. So what's up with that, right? What's that about, that we actually actively have a technique? Again, the chorus. Hallelujah, appreciative joy. So it's a contrived technique, right? We intentionally think of a being, if we can, someone we love a lot, care a lot about. Anyone who's a parent or a grandparent knows how this feels, because just any little success of your children is just really, you just feel so happy. But in sort of ordinary life, people we work with, our siblings, friends, what comes up when they have success? What comes up is competitiveness, jealousy, envy, or that sense that this is another example of how we are completely worthless, right? So these kinds of feelings come up when someone brings us some really good news. And of course, it's worse if, you know, we're working with them, they got the raise, we didn't. Ooh, that's hard. Or in school, remember back in school, they got the A, we didn't. Those kinds of things, when we're actually set up by the world to be in a competition. So the antidote to comparing and judging and this competitive energy, envy, and so forth, is the ability to experience appreciative joy. But it doesn't come easy. We train in it. We actually have to train in it, so we have these techniques. So then, think about that in relation to your own sitting meditation practice, your mindfulness practice, and particularly that voice in there that's always comparing, always judging. Is our practice good enough? Are the other people in the room practicing better than we are? I remember years and years ago, James Barras was talking about this, and he noticed as he went out to do his walking meditation that his eyes were always kind of looking at the people around him to see, you know, how they were walking, and comparing, you know, how, if he was doing his walking meditation. So then he developed a technique when he saw his mind doing that. He said to himself, looking good. Just to really bring in the humor, you know, and that sense of seeing that the comparing mind was present, even in a group, you know, in a group of, you know, several dozen, 100 other meditators, you know. I mean, I feel so lucky, you know, when I come and talk to groups about meditation. These are the most excellent people on the planet, as far as I'm concerned. Whoever shows up at something like this is just among the most excellent people. So then, what is it we're comparing, you know? Am I meditating better than that person? Am I meditating better? You know, it's in here. It's this comparing mind, you know? This judging mind. But if we train in this energy of appreciative joy, so that when someone else is having some success or doing something well, then it'll soften that constant comparing mind, and once again, we'll be able to concentrate better. Concentration will strengthen because there won't be all this distraction of this, just this voice that's always, you know, how am I doing? Am I doing better? Am I doing worse? Well, they're doing worse than me. Well, certainly they are, you know. That one's coughing too loud, and if that one doesn't stop breathing, I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, it's just really amazing what the mind will do. But as we train the heart to feel this joy at other success, then that will lessen that relentless judging, comparing, and our concentration will be strengthened. Isn't that something? Isn't that wonderful? So the Brahmavihara practices, loving kindness, compassion, joy, actually, over time, as a method, it's whether the effects day to day are we like it, we don't, we're bored, we're not, the results can be quite amazing, both in our outer life experience, but also on the cushion in our mindfulness practice and in our ability to concentrate and to open to the moment. And finally, the fourth Brahmavihara is this practice of equanimity, which has to do, again, with learning non-reactivity. Well, that's one of the main, we hope, results of our mindfulness practice, is though we experience strong emotion, that we're less reactive. There's also a quality over time that the equanimity practice gives us, is this sense of equalness, that all beings are equal, that we care about all beings equally, and that our own experience, moment to moment, each experience is of equal value. When we first start meditating, we think the only experiences are those that are calm, relaxed, or bliss. Wouldn't it be nice, a little bliss? That's really good. That means you're meditating well, if you get bliss, right? And if you don't get bliss, if you just get a lot of pain in your body, that means you're not meditating well. But that's not the way it is at all. It doesn't really matter what happens in our meditation practice. The effects of one particular session that doesn't affect the results. The results are one of the most profound results of our practice, of our mindfulness insight practice in everyday life experience, is this less and less reactivity, more equalness, more equanimity. And then in our sitting sessions as well, moment to moment, to have the body sensations, the breath sensations, memories, distractions, whatever is arising, the sense of equalness, we stay with it. The rising and passing, arising and passing, arising and passing. Again, our concentration is stronger, our practice deepens. So these Brahma-Vihara practices, the techniques of loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, equanimity, they are contrived, but they have results that affect both our outside life experience and also really, really strengthen our mindfulness practice. I may have mentioned, I'm not sure if I did, last time I was here, I was speaking about Charlotte Joko Beck, who died last June and is quite an amazing and wonderful American Buddhist. Her perspective on practice, she is very much about bringing it into daily life. And she's a couple of interesting things. One thing she would say is how people were so caught with having dramatic experiences in meditation, and they might come to her, you know, to report on their experiences and say, you know, the light and the body was filled with light and this and that. And she said she would often say, well, that's very nice, but how's it going with your mother? You know, that would be her. She kept directing people back to awareness of practice in daily life and transforming our relationships and things like that. And one time, at one occasion, when she was asked what the purpose of her particular, it was Zen meditation practice, she said the most stunning thing. She said, well, this is about moving from a place of hurting myself and other people to a life of not hurting oneself and other people. That's sort of extraordinary that a great Zen teacher, when asked, of course, that question gets asked and answered in a variety of different ways, but that's a pretty stunning one when asked about the purpose of our practice. To move from a life of hurting ourselves and others to a life of not hurting ourselves and others. Pointing to an extraordinary result also that we would be able to see over time. One of the results would be the lessening of having the experience of hurting oneself or hurting others. And that's worth all of our time. That's definitely worth our time, isn't it? Confidence. Who knew confidence could come from developing compassion? Who knew that we could lessen the incessant judging of the mind by training ourselves to experience more joy? But when you say it, it kind of makes sense. It's just, wow, that sounds like fun. And a great result, right? A wonderful result. So again, I just offer you these observations about these practices that we do, the techniques, things about them.